Now we're happy to have with us this morning Brother Carl W. Beener. As you know, he's member of the General Superintendency of the YMMIA. Brother Beener has established a great record in the church for leadership in various capacities. He's held many church positions, and he's a powerful speaker. He always gives us a challenging message. He's a great favorite, especially among the young people of the church. And in his present capacity in the General Superintendency of the MIA, he is able to perform great service with the youth of the church. And so we are most happy this morning to now have an address from Brother Beener.
President Crockett and members of this great faculty and students of probably the greatest college in the country, it is an inspiring sight to be here and a tremendous honor to be invited to say a few words to you. I've wondered why this privilege comes to one of my humble stature, and I've decided it must have been because I was a Wilkinson for Senate booster. I had a sticker of his on my car until just a few days ago, and I've decided that he's not going to contest the election of Senator Moss at this late stage, and so we've all given up. Just before I left my office this morning, I sort of facetiously said to some of those there, "What shall I tell the students at the Brigham Young University?" And one fellow chirped up and said, "Tell them to be sure and win the WAC Conference Championship." And this I'm sure you're going to do. I'm thrilled for you here. Well, to get a little more serious now, my mind is very disturbed by the general attitude existing among the people of the world. Many leaders of nations and kingdoms are losing influence and control over their subjects. Unrest, disregard for law and order, lack of confidence in established government, threats, strikes, rumors of war, lust for power, enslavement of people, unemployment, hunger, and disease are some of the factors that contribute to this situation. In the midst of all this is the kingdom referred to as a stone cut out of the mountain without hands, which would grow until it fills the whole earth. It is growing. Its leaders are loved and respected. Its message is still, love the Lord thy God, love thy neighbor, peace on earth, do unto others, and so on. This kingdom is growing in numbers, in power, and in influence. It contains the ingredients to save mankind. Most of us present this morning are members of this kingdom, the Lord's kingdom, His church established for the well-being and salvation of His children. Now, I thought you might be interested this morning in hearing some of the observations of what the greatest Christian church in the world feels about the Mormon church. A very fine article was written recently in the U.S. Catholic, entitled, "What I Like About the Mormons." The author is William J. Whalen, a Catholic writer of some note. And when a church with 42 million members in the United States alone becomes interested in the Mormon church, who has a little over 2 million in the world, and begin to point out some of the things they like about this church, I thought maybe you'd be interested in some of these observations. They're not all 100% accurate, But I think a very careful study's been made by Mr. Whalen, and I thought this article might be interesting to you. Most of my friends who have gotten to know Mormons as neighbors, classmates, fellow employees, or army buddies hold a high opinion of them. They characterize Mormons they have known as clean-living, industrious, honest, sober, and friendly. One priest told me the Mormons he knew in the Army comprised the finest group of men he encountered in the service. Although I find Mormon theology a bizarre concoction hardly deserving the name Christian, and although I must object to a number of Mormon beliefs and practices, I share the good opinion of my friends about Mormons as people. That such men and women are products of a religious system which includes secret temple rites, racial myths, polytheism, golden plates, and magic spectacles, the ideal of polygamy and other curiosities remains a mystery. No longer is close contact with Mormons confined to natives of the Rocky Mountain states. Most of the world's 2 million Mormons live outside of Utah. Large communities of Mormons have settled in Southern California, Washington, D.C., Midwestern college towns, and other Western states such as Idaho, Nevada, and Arizona. And then I've inserted here that they are also in nearly every other state of the Union, and in many parts of the world, including New Zealand, Australia, the countries of Europe, Canada, South America, the Far East, the Hawaiian Islands, and nearly everywhere that Mormon missionaries are permitted to go, you'll find groups of Mormons. Mormons serve as governor of Michigan, president of the University of Minnesota, and secretary of the Interior. I don't know why this man limited to three the number of Mormons serving him in important positions, because we could have pages of them. For millions of Gentiles, as non-Mormons are called, the first encounter with Mormons may be the visit of two dark-suited young men at the front door. They belong to an army of nearly 12,000 Mormon missionaries trying to win converts around the world to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. These missionaries, usually men in their early 20s, volunteer for two-year assignments. Selection by church officials to serve in this capacity is looked upon as a high honor. The young man or woman so chosen readily leaves home, college studies, or a job to report for his assignment. They receive no pay while serving on the mission. They are supposed to be their own. They are supported by their own savings or by their families or wealthy Mormon businessmen. The church itself pays only for their return ticket home when they finish their tour. Many of these fledgling missionaries make up in zeal and dedication what they may lack in theological sophistication. Outside of their Sunday school training or perhaps college religion course at Brigham Young University, their preparation for their evangelistic work may be limited to the 2-week short course in mission techniques at Salt Lake City. They may not even know the language spoken by the people to whom they are sent, but confidently expect the Lord to bestow the gift of tongues. The church provides a step-by-step course of instruction for convert making, along with a kit of visual aids and publications. The volunteers are told to stick to the 6 lessons when they find a willing listener. Despite their lack of formal religious training and their inexperience, they are not wasting their time. If convert statistics are any guide, during 1963, the Mormon Church reported 115,000 adult converts, most of whom entered the church through the efforts of these young missionaries. In comparison, The 42 million members of the Catholic Church in the United States gained only 125,000 converts in 1963. Not only does the Mormon Church gain tens of thousands of new members through this mission system, but it cements the loyalty of the young people who respond to these calls. A man who has given 2 years of his life to his church and who has personally instructed and baptized converts will probably remain a dedicated church member to his deathbed. Even if the calls on householders do not result in conversions, the missionaries, the cream of Mormondom, usually make a favorable impression on the Gentiles and help form a more favorable image for their church. Since World War II, the lay missionary movement has taken hold in the Catholic Church, too. Hundreds of men and women, married and single, now serve as lay missionaries, especially in Latin America. Whether an expansion of such programs to include the 2-year assignments on the Mormon model is feasible might be investigated. The opportunities for the Catholic mission volunteer interested in the home missions is also limited. One of the major differences to date between the Mormons and the Catholic lay missionary programs is that whereas the Catholic lay missionary is the exception, the Mormon who volunteers for such work is the rule. We Catholics have not yet developed the apostolic spirit which sees such a 2-year commitment as the normal and expected thing to do. One of the requirements which the Mormon missionaries make plain to every prospective convert is that of tithing. Every Mormon is expected to contribute 10% of his gross income to the church and another 2 or 3% to the upkeep of his local ward. If he does not tithe, he is not considered a member in good standing. He will not qualify to enter a Mormon temple to perform the sacred ordinances for the living and the dead. He may not be married for time and eternity in a temple. The Catholic Church will never insist on tithing as a membership requirement, and I am glad she will not. Nevertheless, one of the commandments of the Church relates to church support, and it is evident that many Catholic wage earners fail to pull their share of the load. Many of the current worries and complaints over the educational quality and even the very existence of parochial schools would end if Catholics donated even a half a tithe to the church. A dollar a week from the employed Catholic will simply not support the needed lay teachers, the hundreds of charitable institutions of the church, the many Catholic colleges and universities, the worldwide missions, etc. The sums collected by the Mormon Church from the tithes of faithful members, including an estimated 300 millionaires, enables that church to engage in an extensive program of welfare, education, public relations, broadcasting, building, and missions. The spirit of genuine sacrifice attached to strict tithing by Mormon families is something I am bound to admire. When a large family earns $6,000 a year and first gives $600 to the church, it establishes a priority of values which cannot help but serve as an example to the children. The same measure of sacrificial giving by Catholics would enable our own church to expand her far-flung educational, charitable, and missionary efforts. That we have a long way to go to match Mormonism's record is indicated by the average of 27 cents a year which American Catholics give to the propagation of the faith. No doubt, one of the chief attractions of Mormonism for born members as well as converts is the extreme church welfare program. Although the boast that no Mormon has ever to go on relief may be doubted, It is true that Mormons in good standing can usually count on receiving substantial help in the form of food, clothing, cash, and help in landing a job. Begun in 1936, the church-sponsored welfare program now embraces 600 church farms, canneries, storehouses, manufacturing firms, and so forth. Needy Mormons may apply for help in case of sickness, unemployment, or other personal difficulties. By its emphasis on welfare activities, the Mormon Church demonstrates its interest in the material as well as the spiritual welfare of its adherents. Those who have must share with those who have not. Later, those who have been helped are asked to replenish the supplies when they are back on their feet. Like tithing, the welfare program provides a secondary benefit in drawing people away from a preoccupation with self-needs and materialism. Catholic programs seldom come close to the Mormon welfare program in comprehensiveness, that is, in furnishing of food, clothing, shelter, jobs, loans, and so forth. Many Christians display a real concern for the material well-being of their fellow Christians, but the daily concern for co-religionists who may be ill or unemployed is not characteristic of the Catholic or Protestant denominations, as it is of Mormonism. One Mormon custom related to the welfare program, which could well be adopted by other churches, is Fast Sunday. On the first Sunday of each month, devout Mormons give up 2 full meals and contribute what they would have spent for this food to the church welfare fund. This money goes to buy food for those temporarily unable to pay for it themselves. Catholics fast during Lent and on Ember days, but seldom is it suggested that the cost of this uneaten food be donated to help feed the hungry. Such a direct connection between fasting and the feeding of the hungry might make the practice of fasting more spiritually rewarding. Material aid to the needy is not the only distinctive feature of Mormonism. The church offers a full religious and social program for Mormons of all ages. Every denomination sponsors youth groups and ladies' aid societies and men's clubs, but I think it is safe to say that none comes close to matching the Mormon organizations. The pioneer Mormons who went west were said to have first built a ward chapel and then a dance hall. They frowned on the use of liquor and tobacco and coffee, but these early Mormons were never influenced by the Puritan disapproval of dancing and dramatics. The Mormon Church has always encouraged all types of wholesome recreation, including dancing, scouting, discussion groups, crafts, amateur theatricals, singing, sports. An appropriate organization exists in an established ward for the Mormon of every age group, from preschooler to senior citizen. We Catholics already own the physical facilities for such a comprehensive social program, but we have concentrated our efforts and manpower on the education of grade school children. Too often our gyms and classrooms and social rooms remain dark and shuttered after our school hours. Perhaps the pastor has an exaggerated fear of shoe marks or littered paper. Young people in the parish or neighborhood who might use these facilities at night or weekends must go instead to the YMCA, the pool hall, or the street corner. How many Catholic parishes sponsor solid programs for senior citizens, young adults, married couples? We might well examine the Mormon pattern to see what could be adapted to the average Catholic parish. Some Protestant denominations have tried to erase the distinction between clergy and laity by stripping the clergy of titles, special garb. Mormonism broke down the distinction by ordaining all qualified male members into the priesthood. Only a handful of Mormon officials draw any church salary. Local pastors, called bishops, serve without pay and support themselves at secular jobs. So do all other officers of the ward, such as the bishop's counselors. A Mormon male becomes eligible for ordination to the grade of deacon when he reaches the age of 12. As he grows older, he may be advanced to other offices, such as that of elder, teacher, priest, and high priest. Each order of the priesthood is responsible for certain spiritual and material duties within the ward. What this system fosters is a deep and personal involvement in the work of the Mormon Church and a close identification with its objectives. Obviously, the Catholic Church cannot operate under the same system. Our church sets apart and ordains certain men for its priesthood, men who will offer sacrifice at the altar, absolve sins in the sacrament of penance, and preach the gospel. To prepare for their responsibilities, they undergo a lengthy course of seminary instruction, and they are freed from the necessity of earning their living at a job other than their priestly one. As many others have observed, however, most priests in parish life find themselves saddled with a long list of secular chores which eat into the time available for spiritual duties and which could just as easily be handled by competent laymen. Again, we might find some examples in the Mormon system which could be adapted to the Catholic Church. These are a few of the things I like about Mormons as I have come to know them in the course of research for my book, The Latter-day Saints in the Modern-Day World. There are other features I admire: their emphasis on chastity and strong family life, their concern for bodily health as expressed in the so-called Word of Wisdom, their encouragement of education at all levels. I'm afraid there are many other features of Mormonism which repel me. The theological reasoning which brands the Negro as spiritually inferior, the general suspicion of church authorities toward Gentile scholars, the church's deep involvement in business affairs in the Western states, the absence of self-criticism in Mormonism, the favoring of conservative businessmen as church officials, the disdain for Catholicism and Protestantism expressed by popular Mormon authors. We Catholics should be able to distinguish the good features from the bad in Mormonism and see what we might do to adapt some of the good features to Catholicism. In the areas of lay missionary activities, the church support welfare program, social activities for all members of the congregation, lay involvement in parish life, and the like, we may find many features which could be incorporated into the life of our own church. Well, I think they've made a pretty good start, don't you? And I think if they keep investigating, they'll find a few more things that might interest the Catholic Church that we already have in our church. I've been thinking about this great earth on which we live, and I've decided it's a great testing ground. Even religion is being tested, all types of religions. And I suppose through the testing process and by the time the end comes here, the Lord will have established which is the great true church for the benefit of everyone else. When I think of the laboratories filled with scientists and students and all of the work going on, all the testing process for nearly everything there is, these great missiles that are shot into the sky to see if they're powerful enough to reach their objective, if they can carry the load designed, atomic bombs to see if they'll go off when and if the time's ever required that they should, and how much power can be expected from one of these explosives. automobiles, the food we eat, the clothes we wear, everything I know about is going through a testing process as we live here in this great laboratory of life. Now, I think the most important of all that's being tested here is man. And he's been placed here in a situation where he's constantly being tried, and he's got to make decisions, either right decisions or find himself in error. And I hope when that day comes, when this great testing period is over for all of us, that we will pass the examination. And maybe when we get to that great place where we're going to be judged and where the King of this kingdom will stand, that he might say to many, you have graduated with honors. You've done a great work in that great laboratory. You're now eligible to come and live with me for the eternities to come. I have a great testimony of this latter-day work. I love it. I love the leadership of the church. I love the things I hear about the BYU and the many things accomplished here at the Brigham Young University. A sight like this is just tremendous, and one never forgets it. So I'm grateful to the Lord for you, for his great church in the earth, for the opportunities we have to go through this testing period, to be tried, to see if we'll be worthy to live with God our Heavenly Father again when that time comes that all of us go through this change. May his peace, his love, and his blessings be with you and this great institution, and may your influence reach far and wide and touch the hearts and lives of thousands who will be attracted to those of you who are either here or who have been here, who've heard about you and who want to know more about you, and that this good influence will bring them into this great kingdom that was as a stone cut out of the mountain without hands, the kingdom of our Father in heaven. I pray and leave my testimony in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.